How does evolution drive our desires and our maybe attraction and crushes towards people?
I mean, there's so many things that matter to that. I mean, a huge amount of the research, right, has focused on things like sex differences and mate preferences, right? And what are the adaptive problems that males and females face in the mating arena? And so I think it's worth pointing out that when we think about adaptations, there's a lot of adaptations or mechanisms that we don't think would have sex differences, right? Like finding food and finding shelter and stuff. All of the things that men and women would have faced the same problems. But people also pointed out that in the mating domain, some of those problems are different. Like, yes, both men and women need to find mates. But what makes a good mate, what increases mate value for males and females may be somewhat different because of the things that men and women are bringing to mateships, right? So if we want to think about some of the factors that might make good female mates, so from the male perspective, right, thinking about mate preferences, youth and fertility, because of what we've just been talking about, are going to be relevant, right? If in the end, what matters is, are you passing on your genes and your preferences to the next generation? If men found postmenopausal women to be the sexiest thing on earth, that probably wouldn't lead to more people.
Yeah.
So youth and fertility, a lot of things that we think of as attractive in women are really indicators of youth and fertility. Quality of skin, quality of hair, shape of the body. You know, do you have a lot of energy? Do you got get up and go? You know, all of these kinds of things, a lot of things that are estrogen markers in terms of facial features, right? These are all things that we think of as being attractive in women, and they're all things that are associated with fertility in youth. And so that's one aspect of things, but that's only one part. That's the offspring production part. But there's also what makes a good mom, right? I mean, is she empathetic? You know, is she kind? Is she good at caring about other individuals? Does she have lots of friends? Does she make good social ties, right? You know, does she have support? And in the modern world, we also may care about things like job opportunities and things like that. But ancestrally, that was probably not something that was really relevant. It was, you know, one of the things that make her a good partner, right? And one of the things that make her a good mom, and one of the good thing, the things that make her good at reproducing, right? These are going to be big factors. If you look at what would be important for women in choosing a partner, right? I mean, physical appearance is going to matter because it is also a health indicator, right? You want the guy to be around long enough. And some of the things that women care about in men's attractiveness, including things like muscularity or the shape of a male's body, indications that he's going to be a good protector ancestrally, maybe that he was a good hunter or a good warrior. Right. There's all of those kinds of traits that relate to physical prowess or a certain amount of aggressiveness in males. And that can also, the environment could influence how important those are. Right. If you live in a more dangerous environment, those things are going to be even more important than they might be if you live in a really benign environment. And then there's, is he going to be a good dad? Is he going to be a good provider? Right. They always talk about how, you know, what are examples of how you would know if a guy's a good dad? Does he have a dog? Does he love his dog? Do you always see him walking his dog? Is he cute with his dog? Yeah, I mean, they talk about studies where people show pictures of women, show women pictures of men with babies and things like that. But pets almost elicit the exact same reaction, right? Because can you care for something else and keep it alive, right? If you can't even keep a plant alive, that might be a bad your parenting skills, right? So that's going to be something that women might care about. And I mean, women are also going to care about things like commitment, right? In terms of his own attachment to her, because that matters for raising offspring. Is he going to be able to accrue resources, whether it's hunting or whatever way in the modern world, whether it's having a good job? Is he going to be able to do that to help provide for offspring? Because that's really important in terms of the survivorship of your children. And how well they'll do in their own environment by how much you've invested in them in terms of time and effort. So things like commitment to her and commitment to children are going to be things that women are going to care about. So often when we talk about mate preferences, we focus on the physical aspects of it. But these other ones are really important when we're talking about long-term mateships. And maybe they matter less, like hooking up. And maybe the attractiveness matters more. But I think in the long run, a lot of these things are going to be important to those choices. And when we think about them in the ancestral environment, you know, you can see very plainly these are going to be, you know, like really important to the survivorship. But even in the modern world, these things matter because we have variations in how much social support there is in the environment. Whether it's social support provided by yourselves, your friends and your family, or whether it's social support that's provided by a government that provides those kinds of features. The data suggests that children that grow up with two parents still tend often to do better because they've got twice as many, you know, individuals providing those resources for them, which is actually one of the things that has been interesting in over the last like 20 or 30 years when people have talked about like things like gay marriage, right? And people raising children, it's better to have two parents, regardless of who the parents are, because there's two people to contribute those resources, supervision, you know, stuff, which doesn't mean that single parents don't sometimes do a really good job, but it's a lot harder job than to do, right? Because they have to provide what two people would have provided, or maybe two people in a village, right? If you've got really supportive family, it can actually make a huge difference. But if you don't, it makes that really tough.
Yeah. You've reminded me to water my girlfriend's plants after this. I have done it in the last week, but I should increase it.
It's a good plan.
Yeah. And also with the dog thing, there's a lot of advice I remember people saying when it comes to dating apps and for men to have a picture of them with like a pet. And does the data show that actually increases their success on dating apps? Hey guys, first of all, I want to say thank you. There's one person who's been sharing the podcast more than anybody else, and that is you. The only reason why this podcast continues to grow is because you are sharing it. And my only ask is, if this podcast has provided value to you or you think it'll provide value to somebody else, then if you could send them a DM of the link or a screenshot to the show, that would genuinely make my day. And it's the only way the podcast will continue to grow. That's my only ask of you. Thank you very much.
Research that's been done looking at it suggests it does at least increase the response rate, right? The swiping aspect of it. I don't know whether it, you know, I guess it, whether it increases the accuracy of them forming relationships, whether they're meant to be short-term or long-term. I'm not sure that the evidence is so clear on that because I'm not sure anybody's done those follow-up studies. But the people who just have them do it in the lab and have people look at images, yeah, it actually does make a difference.
Wow, that's incredible. And why is it important in general to know what shapes our personality and our desires, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question because like there's a lot of us, I think, that are interested, you know, that are scientists that are just interested in answering questions because we want an answer to the question. We want to understand what shapes behavior. I think it's important maybe when people think that you can change things easily. Because some things are very difficult to change and the cost of changing them could be higher than people want to pay. Like if you find out that a particular trait is mostly genetic, you're not necessarily going to be able to change that with any kind of, you know, social intervention or something like that. Think better about what are the circumstances. Now, there are lots of things that are genetic that, and in fact, most things that we would talk about may have genetic, the mechanism itself may be genetic, but there's a lot of environmental input. And I think my favorite example teaching about this is a non-behavioral example, because the behavioral ones are always complicated. But just simply from a biological standpoint, right, something like height is influenced by genes, right? It's very clear that there are genetic differences between people that shape their height, but there are also nutritional differences that influence people's height as well, right? And so that combination of the environment in which an individual grows up in, right, or even their prenatal environment and their genes, they're combining together to produce this end trait. And so when people talk about wanting to see more of a particular type of behavior, it's useful to understand how much of it is in a sense, flexible and what environmental aspects of it are flexible. So what can we change in the environment that might produce things? So like here's a really unpleasant example from most people's perspective, but again, I'm going to talk about it in terms of an animal instead of people. Randy Thornhill, many, many years ago, did a lot of research looking at environmentally contingent sexual behavior in type of insect, but there's a particular type of fly. In environments where the males have lots and lots of resources, what they do when they want to mate with a female is they get a dead insect and they bring it to the female and they give her a nice dinner and she eats dinner and they have sex with her while she's eating dinner. And that is the preferred female strategy and the preferred male strategy. If males do not have a lot of insect availability to give as these nuptial gifts, as they're called, and there's a lot of competition between other males, they have an alternative strategy where they'll actually cough up some of the protein that they've eaten themselves and offer that to the female. And females don't like that as well, but they will eat it because it's useful for them in the production of their babies. But they spend less time eating it and the male has to get in there and get his business done faster. So again, not as desirable strategy. If males are poor quality and there's very few insects in the environment, they actually have evolved a little organ that helps them hang on to the female and force her to have sex with them.
Wow. Right?
So they will engage in forced sex under that condition. And in the lab, you can just change the environment and get the males to behave differently, right? So it's truly environmentally contingent in that particular insect species. But that's why it's important to understand what is the mechanism and what are the environmental cues that influence it, regardless of what the behavior is. If there's a reason to think you might want to modify the behavior or the people, because it would make everybody happier if the behavior was modified, but or even if it might make life easier for individual people if they could behave,